From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist. And this is a show every week we deal with mental health issues. I generally take a more holistic approach, which means balance in body, mind, and spirit in the healing process. Now, we all know that the truth will set you free. But the question we ask here is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? Now, this is a live call-in show. When you hear my topic, you may be very moved to be calling in and asking questions of myself or my guest. The number, if you're in the Phoenix area or listening outside the Phoenix area over the internet, is 480-949-1310. That's 480-949-1310. The show today, while you may ask, what does it have to do with mental health, because we're going to be talking about some legal issues, is actually called Are You the Next Terri Schiavo? And anybody who listens to radio, as you are right now, or has read the newspaper or watched TV in the last month, have been inundated with the face of Terri Schiavo and that smile on her face and the conflict that's been going on throughout the country and probably conflicts throughout the world around this, having to do with her rights and who has the power to decide whether it's a husband or her parents in terms of her medical care, since she's clearly not in a state to decide for herself. So today we're actually going to be talking about the impact of end-of-life illness or potential end-of-life illness and the importance of having communicated through a durable power of attorney, a living will. We're going to be talking about the differences between those with my guests in a minute, but the importance of actually making your choices and decisions known. And I'm actually going to start by reading a letter, and I'd like you to bear with me. It'll take me about 2 minutes to get through this letter. It was written on December 16, 1993, by a very dear friend of mine named Eileen Rankel. And Eileen and I have been very involved in the AIDS community, as I still am. And she was very involved with a support group by Louise Hay called the Hayride. And Eileen was the epitome of health. She was in her 60s and ran a few miles a day, was a vegetarian, meditated, did all those sort of things, and was at the bedside with me and by herself very often of so many friends and loved ones that had AIDS during the 80s and 90s, and she was one of the true caregivers for so many people. And on December 16, 1993, she wrote this letter, which clearly made her thoughts known. And this letter actually upset a lot of people, but myself and many others truly understood what she was trying to do here. And she writes, "Dear family and friends, please forgive me for using this method of notifying you of a major new experience in my life, but I have neither the time nor the energy to do it any other way. In August, I began to experience vertigo, low-grade nausea, and fatigue, and as a very high-energy person, this did not make me happy. I had just lost three very dear friends in 3 months, so I thought I was having residual grief. But one morning I got up and I felt awful, so I knew something was wrong. I took myself to Kaiser's. They gave me antibiotics and ordered a lot of blood tests and an IVP. This showed I had a blocked left uterus. So I had a non-invasive surgical procedure to dilate the uterus. Then I had a barium and DICAT scan and an upper GI and more blood tests. At this time, I began experiencing abdominal distress and chest tightness. In trying to relieve the abdominal distress by pressing on my abdomen, I discovered I had a small tumor by my navel. I learned that it was called a Sister Mary Joseph tumor. Can you imagine that in non-religious me? I told my internist, and I went in for a needle biopsy of both groins and the tumor by my navel. They called me later that day to come in so they could surgically biopsy the tumor as the needle biopsy was inconclusive. The next afternoon, my doctor called and said the biopsy showed cancer and the prognosis was not good. My doctor set me up with a hematologist-oncologist. Both of my daughters and a friend went with me. Kaiser's recommended a very high prolonged treatment of chemotherapy, which is very toxic and produces many side effects. They treat these side effects with more toxic drugs. My cancer may have started in an ovary, my stomach, or breast and metastasized to my bones and other organs. Without treatment, I may have 3 to 4 months, according to the doctor. With treatment, I may get a remission, but the cancer could still continue to grow even with chemo, and my quality of life would severely be affected. For the past 6 months, I've been a support person for people with AIDS, and I've seen so many of them go downhill so fast after chemo. For lymphoma, leukemia, Hodgkin's, or Kaposi's sarcoma, it works great, but for other things, not so great. Because I'm in good condition, they feel I can tolerate this very toxic chemotherapy that they want to do. I will not do it. I had 4 opinions at Kaiser's, but to make Susie and Kitty feel better, I had my 5th second opinion at Cedars-Sinai with Dr. Sarno. Again, my daughters and 3 friends were with me. His conclusions were similar, but he was interested in finding the origin and recommended a sonogram, an endoscopy, and other procedures so that treatments would be more specific. I thought, well, maybe. However, on the way home, I got absolutely furious. Not at anyone, but at the thought of more procedures, more doctor's offices, etc. Prior to that day, I'd felt totally at peace of no medical treatment. Once I told myself in the car that I didn't have to do anything I didn't want to do, my peace returned. A few people feel that I'm in denial or that I'm putting up a front. I am not. I am at peace. My spiritual beliefs sustain me. I have been taught by champions these past years. They taught me courage, humor in the face of death and dignity. So in reality, I've been preparing for this without knowing it. I never thought I'd get cancer. I thought I'd probably keel over on one of my runs in the morning. Although I can't seem to run at this point in time, I am doing my exercises and walking. Positive note, I'm skinny. When I enter my death process, it will be at home, surrounded by my cats and any family members or friends who'd like to be present. I want no hospital equipment around. The only thing I will do is painkillers, as much as I can get. I have the most incredible support system of family and friends. 2 of my friends insisted in helping me to realize a dream of having a red convertible Miata. I just got it on December 11th, and what fun. I am now cruising around in style. After I die, it will be given to my grandson. As long as I am able, I plan to do my volunteer support and keep up my house. In the next month, I plan to take care of things to make it easy as possible for my daughters. I have completely orchestrated myself a fabulous memorial, of course. I will be cremated, but before then, I will definitely live my life full tilt boogie as long as possible, and I will do some holistic things like visualizations, acupuncture, etc. I thank all of you for being a part of my life, for sharing the moments we had together, for helping me learn the lessons I needed to learn, and for the love we shared. Each and every one of you hold a special place in my heart. If you can attend my celebration of life, please do. It will be fabulous, as only a gay and lesbian affair can be. No, I wasn't a lesbian in this lifetime, but I may come back as a drag queen in the next. I just love their clothes and flamboyance. It was in the gay and lesbian community where I found love and total acceptance. Remember me, and know that until you are at peace with death, you cannot truly experience life. Love and hugs, Eileen. I know that was long, but I honor Eileen by reading it, and it brings home the point of what today's show is about. She was of sound mind and made decisions that for some people was not a very popular one, but she made it. She put it in writing. There was no doubt to her doctors or anyone else what she wanted and how she wanted her end of life to look. And once her daughters and everyone got over the fact that we were losing someone we all loved, all of us were totally supportive of her decision and were there continuously to support her in this process. She lasted another 4 months, and I dedicate today's show to Eileen because of her inspiration and the power of her being. That's what this whole thing with Terry Schiavo has been about. If Terry had put in writing, through a living will, durable power of attorney, or any other thing, the conflict between her husband and her parents would have been a moot point. So today, I actually have two guests that are both experts in this field. One of them is Mark Johnson of Mark Johnson & Associates. He's an attorney in Arizona, in Phoenix, and they deal a lot with what they call preventative law. The other guest I have on today is Ed Heyman, who's also an attorney in Florida, and he's written a number of self-help books, including one called How to Write Your Own Living Will. Mark, Ed, I want to thank you for being on the show today and welcome you. Ed, you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Happy to be here.
Thank you. Ed, I want to start with you for a minute. You're in a cyclone because you're living in Florida. What are your thoughts and experience of what's been going on down there, and why did you write the self-help book on how to write your own living will?
Well, start off with the Schiavo case. It's been an unbelievable roller coaster ride for several years now. I've been constantly amazed at how this just keeps continuing on and on. I think the public really started becoming, you know, paying close attention to it after the Florida governor and legislature got involved in it a few months ago. I've just been on pins and needles waiting to see how it's all going to end. And several times I thought, you know, an end had been reached, and then something new comes up and somebody new gets involved in the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
The main reason I wrote the book was this has been something that seems fairly simple and something that most people should have is a living will. And I just saw a lot of people that weren't getting them because they didn't want to go to the time, trouble, expense, whatever they perceived of going to an attorney and having one drawn up. I've dealt with this situation since when I was in college. My father became terminally ill, and it seems like back in those days, you didn't have living wills and health care powers of attorney, and these things were dealt with kind of within the privacy of the family and the doctors and the hospital.
If they were dealt with at all.
Right. That whole episode with my father, I think, partially led to my sister becoming a psychologist and social worker, and she ended up working with a legislator in Michigan, working on the first law of this type in that state.
Now, we've been using interchangeably living will and durable power of attorney. Can you briefly talk about what the difference between the two are?
Okay, you can look at a living will as kind of like a letter saying what you want to happen if you become terminally ill or permanently unconscious in certain situations.
Can you speak more loudly?
To other people. The healthcare power of attorney actually designates another person to act on your behalf and make those decisions for you.
So in other words, the living will actually sets out what your wishes are, and the durable power of attorney actually assigns someone to back that up.
Correct.
Okay. That explains it to me, because it often confused me. Because in California, the durable power of attorney for health care actually includes both. So in some states, that I'm assuming is the case, because you assign an advocate and two alternates in case they're not readily available. But then there's a section in it where you can check off, you know, I want heroic measures, I don't want heroic measures, and fill in the blanks.
Right. According to my count, there's currently about 46 states that have official living will forms in their statutes. Some of them are pretty basic, and some of them go into great detail outlining a whole bunch of different types of procedures you can either say I want or I don't want.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Arizona seems to be one of the better ones I've seen.
Okay, well, we're going to get to Mark in a minute in terms of what Arizona is doing. So in terms of your book, does the book actually include the forms for various states in it, or is it more in general terms about how to go about it and what to consider in doing it?
Well, I've got about 40 pages of information and instructions, and then we have a section that summarizes the laws for all 50 states in the District of Columbia. And then we've got a big section on forms, which includes the forms for the 46 states that have their own form, plus another form for use in other states.
Mm-hmm.
And it also contains a durable power of attorney for health care form.
Okay, great. Now, Mark, I want to ask you also, in terms of Arizona itself, what can you say about to my listeners in terms of the requirements and legalities of putting these forms together in Arizona?
You know, Stuart, that's an ongoing debate as to how to make it as effective as possible. Arizona Department of Economic Security does have on their website a form that can be downloaded, check the boxes, make sure that it's been witnessed or notarized. If it is witnessed, it has to be by a disinterested party. But the debate within the state bar right now is how effective those documents are when we're talking about trying to identify what circumstances will predicate what kind of actions. And to be honest with you, when you read Eileen's letter, what you were reading, in my opinion, was just as effective as would be some kind of a pre-printed advanced health directive,
mm-hmm.
in that it already identified what it was that she intended to do. It
right.
took away any family guilt. It took away the physician's fear of legal liability. And in the documents that I help prepare for my clients, it's a combination of both. We do want to meet the legal requirements so that a hospital sees it as a living will.
Mm-hmm.
But we also want it to be a little bit folksy. Each person is going to have their own definition of what they want to have done at certain stages. And so it does need to be a little bit of both.
Now, I mean, you just hit on something in terms of my mental health background, and that has to do with family guilt, but also the patient guilt, because Eileen said clearly in her letter that when she started getting angry, she wasn't angry at the disease or anything, but she started getting angry that she wasn't staying true to her own desires. She was being really pressured by her daughters, who did not want to lose her and weren't ready yet to deal with this cancer issue. But when Eileen got centered again, she got empowered again. But a lot of what's going on, and I personally, you know, I'm not going to be like like Frist in the Congress, who's diagnosing a situation just because he saw a videotape, but I am going to say that I can imagine that part of this tug of war is because, you know, her family is feeling a whole range of emotions, from guilt to grief to anger to a lot of different things. And it's those emotions that that guide people's decisions, and the conflict is being guided by emotion instead of reason. So how do you address, when you're working with a client who's putting one of these together, my understanding of most attorneys dealing with stuff like this is really you become a therapist of sorts. You know, you have to, in a sense, counsel people as to how to get through this and how to get clear in terms of what they want. How do you do that?
There's a reason why it's called counselor at law. It you know, usually the living will is part of the structured documents dealing with what to do to minimize taxes and avoid probate, and some of these are really technical issues which need to be prescribed within a trust or a testamentary trust, a last will and testament and such. But the living will is the one document that needs to be really, really well, properly ironed out before it's signed, because that's the one document that when the time comes to implement it, there's probably no time to recover. You're not going to change your mind after that's been implemented.
Mm-hmm.
So the process really is, and coincidentally, just this morning had some clients come in to deal with this specific issue. We do need to identify what procedures there, what the circumstances are under which it will become effective, what procedures they would like to to invoke or which ones that they would rather not have.
Mm-hmm.
They most importantly, though, and I find this becoming a common thread in all states, instead of simply writing a letter to the hospital saying, when these circumstances arise, these are the procedures and policies that I'd like to have followed, we don't know what the situations are going to be like in the medical field in the next 5, 10, or 20 years. So I also implement what I call a surrogate. Different states will, well, I guess that the best way to describe that would be the decision maker. If it seems that maybe one box contradicts another box or that one paragraph might contradict another paragraph in the living will, let's leave the final decision to the surrogate to determine one of two things. Either enforce your will with the hospital and ensure that, you know, even if it's against what the majority of the family might believe to be the best course of action, the one person who has been given the authority to act is the one person who decides what is done.
Mm-hmm.
On the converse, if it looks like everything is in conformance with what the living will would deem the time to pull the plug, and that one surrogate has a funny feeling, or really, maybe intuitively, maybe with their own experience, really wants to give it another couple of days or maybe a couple of weeks, that surrogate is empowered to do that as well. So the decision-making process is twofold. Number one, what does the client want to have implemented and what terms will be specifically written down? But then in those situations that it isn't perhaps 100% clear, who is going to be the decision-maker in that process and who's going to either veto or sue to enforce that decision be followed? It's a very, very difficult decision to be made and one that should take a couple of weeks, if not a little bit longer, to make sure you've got the right person in charge.
Well, from a personal perspective, Annette, I want you can comment on this also. I'm a gay man, and a lot of my gay friends who were dealing with HIV and AIDS, especially through the 80s and 90s when people were getting so sick and dying en masse, actually, it wasn't necessarily mom or dad or a sibling that they wanted. There was too much conflict and too much distance between them. So very often, like I had been and still am the advocate or the durable power of attorney for a number of friends, and I was the one that had to, what you say, advocate for them when they couldn't. But it also meant, and this is important for people to consider, that a lot of people think, well, I'll have mom or dad or my brother or sister do this because their feelings will be hurt if I don't, as opposed to who really knows me, who's been part of my life on a regular basis. And in terms of a gay or lesbian person, it may be their partner, which may or may not make the family very happy. But this is what documents the fact that that's the choice of the individual. But very often, you need to consider someone who has the strength and the clarity, not just to deal with their own grief and sadness about you're getting sicker and possibly dying and being able to really honor your wishes and hold on to that, but also someone who's capable of dealing with the family who shows up and who may have the best of intentions also and who may or may not agree with those wishes. So it needs to be someone who you feel really has the strength to cope with all of that at one point, wouldn't you say?
Definitely.
Either one.
Absolutely.
What's your
agree with
experience?
Everything that Mark has said, and you're correct, Stuart.
I can't hear you.
Why
can
it's important to talk to the person that you want to designate and make sure that you feel they have the strength and that they understand your wishes and that they can agree with your wishes.
Mm-hmm. You know, and very, very often, like in the Terry Schiavo case, I mean, the feelings and philosophy of Michael Schiavo, as opposed to Terry's parents, the Schindlers, they obviously have very different approaches to this. And so they're at conflict. And, you know, we can only go with, I mean, it's like Michael's her husband. Legally, he should have the say-so here. And yet all this conflict grew up around it. And having these papers written, as I said earlier, would have avoided this whole thing. And so when we're talking about this end-of-life situation, you know, we're really talking about dealing with something that most people don't want to talk about and don't want to deal with. There are a lot of people out there that don't even have wills because they don't want to deal with the issue of death. And like Eileen said at the end of her letter, know that until you are at peace with death, you cannot truly experience life. So in terms of getting people, like Ed, when someone comes, you're a practicing attorney, right?
Right.
Okay, when someone comes into your office and they're talking about getting their wills together and stuff, how do you approach them on dealing with a living will? Wills definitely are talking about after I die, but what's more difficult for most people is to talk about when I'm dying. So how do you approach that with them?
Well, usually you're dealing with this, as Mark had said, in the context of an overall future planning that involves, you know, probate avoidance and other things. And dealing with the subject of a living will isn't that far off from dealing with a will. You're still talking about death situations. And it's just brought up as a list of, part of the list of different documents that are recommended.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the current things that's being discussed in the Florida bar now is not just having a power of attorney that designates who you do want, but also listing possibly specific people you do not want to have any decision making.
Wow, that I haven't heard before. How's that debate going?
That's basically what's being recommended. I attended a seminar a few weeks ago that was specifically on the ramifications of the Schiavo case. And that was one of the things that was being advocated by some of the panel members.
So in terms of somebody who actually is having a lot of conflict, which, you know, again, getting back to gay and lesbian couples, when families have, in a sense, rejected them because of their sexual orientation and have not acknowledged their partnering, they can very clearly say that, you know, those family members, meaning mom or dad or both or brothers, sisters and stuff, you know, have no say in this matter, and it could be clearly stated.
Oh, definitely. And the other situation would simply be if you happen to know that a family member disagrees with your beliefs about end-of-life decisions.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, Stuart, if I could interject here just one second.
With
my GLBT clients, we do address those same issues because, again, domestic partnership really doesn't have any bearing as far as the decision-making capacity is concerned. And the laws of the state of Arizona state that even in the absence of a medical directive, a health care power of attorney, a living will, or a pull-the-plug document, however you want to coin the phrase, that the powers will that the decision-making can still be honored by the hospital if made by a husband or wife, unless they're separated,
mm-hmm.
or an adult child, or a majority if there's more than one,
mm-hmm.
your mother, your father, and it does, it has its own line of succession, but in those occasions, in those situations where children and or parents or, you know, spouses just really aren't the proper ones to make those decisions, it's imperative that those issues be addressed with some general estate planning and emergency preparedness documents.
Mm-hmm.
Going back to Ed's discussion on how those issues are broached with clients, it's something that needs to be well thought out, but it's not really that difficult, in my experience anyway, for the clients to come up with, in the course of communication, what is it that we're trying to accomplish? Well, we want to make sure that we're providing for each other. Who are the decision makers in this process? Obviously each other, and then maybe some close friends or family members. What are the things that need to be contemplated in this decision-making process? What are the assets that will need to be managed? And then the next logical question is, these are the decision makers in the event of death. Who will be the decision makers in the event of disability? And so it's kind of a logical progression if it's treated properly. But once again, it's not something to be answered in a knee-jerk fashion. They do need to spend some time making sure that not just that it is the right person, but that the proper backup number one and backup number two have been identified. And it's interesting, Ed, to hear that Florida is contemplating not just who you want to name, but who you don't want to name. I don't know that Arizona Gloss really addresses that specifically. That's something that we've just kind of done on a case by case or client by client basis. But I will definitely be interested in seeing how that turns out.
Yeah, and I think you're going to see more of that because of the Schiavo case. And I also think you're probably going to have an easier time discussing this with people because everybody in the country seems to be, you know, pretty emotionally charged and aware of the whole situation now.
Sure.
Definitely. Well, you know, when I was putting the show together, the homepage, and they list the five, every day they list the five most popular searches. And 2 days ago, living wills was the number one popular search. So this has really activated people all over the place to get more information. Number three was Terry Schiavo.
Wow.
Now go figure. Demi Moore was number two, so I'm not sure how that fit in. But the fact is that this has generated what I've been professing since the AIDS epidemic started, because it was such a reality that we had to deal with. I mean, I had situations with some friends who didn't have wills or living wills at the time, and family members who have been totally disassociated with them for years came in, pushed the partner totally out of the picture because there was no legal rights for them anyway, and took over everything, doing all the things that the partner knew that their loved one didn't want, and also basically took over the estate when they died. So the importance of this, and it's not just for same-sex couples, it's also for unmarried heterosexual couples, too, that are dealing with these situations, that it gives a legal foundation and a legal basis for being the support for someone that you love.
An ounce of prevention, the pound of cure.
Yeah.
I probably deal with these types of situations, again, be it same-sex or not, on twice, maybe three times a month. We'll receive calls where, because of a separation for financial reasons, the surviving spouse in a 20 or 25 year marriage is left high and dry on life insurance proceeds because they really thought that everything was in place. They didn't realize that legal separation had modified the entire process. The same is true with same sex couples, where when one passes away, the intention was there, but legally and technically, the rights aren't the same. And I can't emphasize enough, whether it be a fill-in-the-blank from the Department of Economic Security, a well-written letter like Eileen's, even well before the fact, or any number of forms, anything is better than nothing, with the idea that as life changes, it needs to be updated, as medical procedures and as state laws vary, they need to be updated. It's not necessarily a pleasant idea to talk about, but it does need to be addressed at least every couple of years.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that I found that a lot of people don't really talk about, and I don't know if you as attorneys really bring this home to clients when you're helping them prepare these things, but if someone's doing this on their own, they need to know this, that when you do this living will or durable power of attorney, especially if you're assigning a particular person to be your advocate, copies need to be made of this and given to every family member so there's no doubt, and so that any discussion that needs to take place takes place well before the crisis occurs. And every time that you have a hospital admission, you need to bring another copy with you, because the copy you had last time is now stored away in a file in the archives, possibly, and your files may be so big that they don't even know to look at it. Every time you're admitted to the hospital, bring another copy so that it's put in the front of every current chart that you have. Make sure your doctor gets it, and every time you update it or change it, you need to go through the entire procedure again so that there's no conflict or doubt, or somebody can't find their copy so that the doctors are not going to honor your wishes because it got misplaced. So do you deal with that? Is that something that either one of you really bring home to your clients when you're dealing with this?
Ed, that's a loaded question. I'll let you handle that first.
Have a copy for the person they've designated as their health care agent, and also give one to their primary physician. Mm-hmm. Now, I've got a healthcare power of attorney for my mother who has Alzheimer's and is 83 years old. And every time she goes to the hospital, they ask me for another copy. I don't know what they're doing with them. I guess they're doing what Stuart said and found them away somewhere. But every time I go to the same hospital, they want to see it again. The other thing I would mention is that if you're traveling, make sure you take a copy with you.
Oh, excellent point.
You know, and I have a couple of other points to make, or maybe some preventive practices as well. When we prepare estate planning documents for our clients, we include in that package, we call them medical emergency information forms. On that, you disclose who you are, who your next decision makers are, how to contact them, what your blood type is, any allergies, and predominantly on that card, whether or not you have a living will, and if so, where it's located. So in the event of a car accident or, you know, had instances where people have had heart problems while out jogging, you know, you don't carry your living will on your person at all times. At least have that information in a disclosed location on your person.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely keep a copy with healthcare agent or your surrogate. As far as disclosing it to the hospital, I kind of have a two-prong approach on that. Once again, the living will is so important that it needs to be reviewed, and you need to be 100% assured of all those provisions before, in my opinion, before you give it to the hospital. And for those clients who are going in for a surgery, I prepare a letter to the hospital advising them that the client has a living will, and that the right person will bring that document to the hospital if situations arise where it becomes necessary. The problem with giving the living will to the hospital each and every time you're there is that, like you said, maybe you're giving it to the hospital 20 times in a year, 10 times in a year. If you change your mind and come up with a newer living will, who knows how many previous copies are in the files and which copy might be dependent upon in the event of an emergency. So it really boils down to how sure you are that that's the document you want,
right,
before you decide whether or not to give it to the healthcare facilities. Not to the decision maker, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Well, but like at this point already, I know that the hospitals here in L.A. will ask upon admission, do you have a living will? Do you have a durable power of attorney for healthcare? Do you have a copy with you? So at this point, I know in L.A., I believe this really came out of the AIDS crisis here in L.A., that it's a routine part of hospital admissions here. I don't know if it's true in Florida and in Arizona. What can you say?
I think it's pretty routine here in Florida.
It's routine in Arizona as well.
Great.
And if you don't have one, or if you say that you don't have one elsewhere, they will have you fill out the orange form, and they'll put an orange identification bracelet on you.
Mm-hmm.
But once again, if you acknowledge the fact that you have one, you don't have to sign theirs, which might supersede yours.
What is the orange form in an orange bracelet in Arizona?
That would be the hospital's internal form that they use for the living will.
In other words, upon admission, they're asking you to make that decision and to fill it in.
If you don't already have one.
If you don't already have one.
Then they will ask you to fill out theirs.
Well, let's talk then again about the way people can go about this. Because there are a number of routes to do this. Obviously, there are books like Ed Heyman's about how to write your own living will, and it's very detailed and will give you all the information you possibly need to do your homework on your own. There are websites you can go to for this, including both of your sites, which we'll get into in a little bit. People can get these forms very easily, downloading them off websites, purchasing them online. You can actually go to Office Depot and Staples and places like that and go to the legal forms department where you get leases and everything else, and for your particular state, they'll be on those racks. And some of them are very much fill in the blank. But some people don't have the confidence that they really know what they're doing. But having those forms in front of them can at least bring up the questions they need to ask. Now, there are other people who clearly want to sit face-to-face with an attorney and do this. And to me, having the forms first might be a good lead-in, or actually, if you don't have an attorney, you know, looking it up, asking friends who help them with theirs is another way of doing it. So some of it can be as simple as filling in the blanks. Some of it is something that you really want someone like Ed or like Mark, who have dealt with this over and over again, who are going to ask you the right questions and guide you in the right directions, who are not emotionally involved with the situation, who are going to be much more rational. So there's a time and a place for all of this, whether it's a pre-printed document or whether you go through an attorney. How often do you have clients that actually come to you with the forms in hand, either one of you? Ed?
Go ahead, Ed.
I probably rarely have anybody come with forms in hand.
Mm-hmm.
I would agree. The exception would be those clients who have maybe moved from a different state and want a review and a full opinion. But coming in with forms that they were anticipating filling out, I don't see that very often. I can't say I've ever seen that.
Okay.
Hey, Stuart.
So those people that actually are coming in to get these things done, what are the first questions they're usually asking you when it comes to living will or durable power of attorney?
Go ahead, Mark.
Mark,
you
there?
I ask them the questions first. And the interview or the consultation usually begins with, what are your goals and objectives and concerns? Is it a tax issue, a probate avoidance issue, an emergency preparedness issue? Do you want a significant other than family members to be the decision makers? And kind of let them set the stage. The questions with those clients who come from different states, once again, really are focused on, are these documents still effective? I've moved from, you know, these were created 5 or 6 years ago. They were from Missouri or Illinois. Are they still good here in the state of Arizona? And if not, what specifically needs to be updated to make them current with Arizona? Now, to be honest with you, that's a pet peeve of mine. It's not that difficult to create documents that will be effective and honored in every state of the union. So when I do see that the documents are created that probably won't work in one state or another, my recommendation is let's get it done right so that even after you move, after this point, these documents will still be effective.
Well, like Ed said earlier, if you travel in another state, that they'll still be honored.
Absolutely.
Stuart, we have your next guest. Charles King is on the
line. There's also kind of a paradox here that doctors and hospital administrators, you know, in a state are used to seeing their state's form. So if they see something that doesn't look familiar to them, it may prompt them to be more likely to question it.
That is true. And once again, we can try to make them as effective in all states as possible with the understanding, like you've just said in Florida, that state legislatures, whenever they're in session, will always be modifying things from one degree to another. But as far as trying to preempt some questions as to the effectiveness in a different state, I make it a practice to attach a certificate at the end of the document that discloses that I'm a licensed attorney in the state of Arizona, that upon my review, it's legally valid, it's binding and effective in all respects, that it complies with all the applicable laws, and that if anybody has any questions regarding interpretation or whether or not it might have been modified subsequent to that date, that they can contact me. And that basically, the attempt is to keep the hospitals or the doctors from shifting the burden of proof to the agent and telling them if they have problems, this is my number, email address, phone number, my state bar number, and if they really need any additional information, give me a call. Otherwise, take it at face value.
Stuart.
Yes.
This is Robert back at the station here. Your next guest, Charles King, is on hold for you.
Who do we have online?
Charles?
Charles.
Yes.
You there, Charles?
Stuart?
Yes, Charles?
Can you hear me?
Hey, yeah. Actually, I want to introduce you to my listeners. This is Charles King, and he has a business that's a mobile notary business. And when I talked to him, and I want to thank you, actually, because you've become a sponsor for the show. And when I talked to Charles, who is in Phoenix, you know, he told me that he deals with helping people get these things done very often, in other words, shows up at their homes or hospital beds to notarize these forms. And so I wanted you to let people know how they can contact you and what's been your experience, because unfortunately all too often these things end up being done when someone's already admitted to the hospital. So what's your experience with this, Charles?
My experience is that, of course, people do wait for they're ready to make a decision, or they've had a car accident and they need somebody to take care of their bank account, pay the bills, and they can't have anybody do that for them because it's taken care of. And I'm at the hospital with them trying to get it done. They're in a lot of pain. That I've had is I actually showed up at the hospital to take care of documents for a living will and everything. So I couldn't do anything for her. And luckily she came out 2 weeks later. I was able to take care of her. There's nothing that can be done for these people.
So in other words, and someone's already been in a coma or too out of it to be able to document the fact that this person was of sound mind when you notarized it, and there was nothing you could do, is what you're saying. Okay, I think we lost Charles here. Mark, Ed, you still there?
Hello?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm still here. Okay.
So what Charles was saying, and I really want to bring this home, is that if people are waiting to the last minute and you're being admitted, you may or may not be in sound mind for a notary to actually acknowledge your signature and acknowledge your decision here. But very often he is called into hospitals to do these things upon admission because someone's going into surgery or because of an accident or things like that. And so a good part of Mark's business, which is a mobile notary, is hospital visits to get these things done at the last minute. Now, he can also come to your home when these things are being done. So if you're doing a do-it-yourself form and need it notarized, he's available. And you can get more information about Mark King and his mobile notary at his website, which is www.rainbowprof.com, RainbowProf.com. And you can also get information and get that hyperlink on my website. So I want to give both of you, Mark and Ed, a chance to talk about your website, how people can get your book. Ed, why don't we start with you, and then we'll finish with Mark in terms of what he's doing in Phoenix.
Okay. It should be available at all local bookstores, and if they don't have it in, they can order it. Other places would be Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble, which I believe is BN.com, or from the publisher directly, which is sourcebooks.com.
That's SourceBooks.com. And the name of the book is How to Write Your Own Living Will, correct?
Correct.
Okay. And anything else that you're involved with at this point that you want to talk about?
The only thing I was going to add was that, you know, I know there's people with religious beliefs who want everything possible done for them, and that can also be put into a living will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the living will state, you know, some of the fill-in-the-blank ones actually have lines saying, use all the heroic measures you possibly can to keep me alive, even if I'm in a vegetative state. And then there's the other end that said, I don't want any artificial means used to keep me alive. So the living will specifically, like you're saying, it's not just to avoid the heroic measures. It's to let people know that's what you want, if that's what you want.
Right.
Mark, how about you? I know that you're in Phoenix. How can people reach you if they want to? I know you have a website, johnsonlaw.info.
Right.
Go ahead.
That's a real easy way to get a hold of us, to request articles, to sign up for upcoming workshops or presentations, and even
what?
We do split our time about equally between Scottsdale and Flagstaff, so one way or the other, whether by phone or by email, we'll definitely be able to respond to whatever the questions are.
And they can get that through information, and it's The firm is Mark L. Johnson & Associates, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. We're coming to the close of the show. I am sorry about the technical problems, if any of you were hearing it over the air. It happens sometimes, and I truly want to thank Ed for you taking the time. I know it's late in the afternoon on Saturday for you in Florida, and thank you so much for being here today and for your wisdom and your help in this issue.
My pleasure.
And Mark also, I want to remind people who are listening in Phoenix that Mark is a local attorney there, Mark L. Johnson and Associates. And on his website, they talk about preventative law, which I really like, that being a holistic and preventative health care person and mental health person. I really like that approach, preventative law. In other words, how to prevent the conflicts and insanity that's been going on with the Terri Schiavo case. So, Mark, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Sure, it's been an honor. Thank you.
And people can reach you, again, either on your website, johnsonlaw.info, not .com, but .info, I-N-F-O. And they can also get the hyperlinks on my website, tellthetruthfaster.com. And in about a week or so, this show will be archived. So if you have someone that you really feel needed to hear this information, they'll be able to just click on the topic in about a week and a half and listen to the whole thing again. And I invite you to make use of the archives, because I archive every show I've done for the last 3 years, a wide range of topics. So thank you both again.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Now, in closing, again, I dedicated today's show to Eileen, but I'm also dedicating it to so many other friends that have been in this situation through the 80s and 90s. I think I've been the designated advocate for at least 10 or 15 different friends, and I'm still listed for some. And even though I'm HIV negative, what this brought home through all those years is how important it was for myself to have the same forms done. And Terri Schiavo is in the situation she's in because of an eating disorder. And the eating disorder led to what I think was a stroke that kept oxygen from her brain and caused this vegetative state. We never know when something's going to happen. All too many times people, even young adults, midlife people, middle-aged people think, well, I got plenty of time to do this. The reality of it is we never know how much time we have to handle these things. I really encourage all of you to deal with the issues. Again, like Eileen said, if you haven't dealt with death, if you haven't been able to deal with the possibility of your death and the dying process, you can't live fully, because you're living in fear of that possible time or inevitable time when you're going to be in that situation. Most people deny and avoid those emotional things that are uncomfortable. And again, we all know that the truth will set you free, but how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? Deal with these issues. Talk to your family and friends. Talk to an attorney. Get these things done. Free yourself up from any subconscious and subtle anxiety that might exist. But for most of us, because of this Terri Schiavo situation, it's not so subtle and subconscious right now. Take action. So I pray for Terry.